If a product contains genetically modified ingredients, should it have to say so on the label?
I think voluntary labeling is it's a dodge. It's dishonest. It means no labeling at all.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the great GMO label debate. And please pay attention, there's a quiz. Also, we talked to the investigative journalist who broke the story of the lead water crisis in Flint, Michigan.
These people were poisoned because the state was trying to save some money.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Reports of lead-tainted water poisoning children in Flint, Michigan have raised concerns for people in other cities with lead piping infrastructure. That includes most older Pennsylvania cities. Many water utilities, including Philadelphia and Pittsburgh's, offer free testing for lead levels for anyone who requests it. Manager of External Affairs for the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority, Brendan Schubert, says in a normal year, the authority receives 25 to 50 requests. He says in the first 2 months of this year, they received 240.
We've actually sent those out to a third-party lab to analyze them because of the number of requests that we've gotten.
In Philadelphia, the increase is not as dramatic. In an average year, the Philadelphia Water Department receives 8 requests for lead tests, but they've already received about 3 times that many. In both cities, some homeowners may opt to use private labs to test their water. In 2014, when residents in Flint, Michigan were complaining that their water tasted bad and in some cases was hurting their eyes when they showered with it, they were told by the city that the water was safe. It took veteran investigative reporter Kurt Guyette to expose the high levels of lead in the drinking water. As part of his work with the ACLU of Michigan, he was looking into places like Flint where emergency managers were running the city. Working with citizens and scientists, he proved that the emergency manager's decision to switch Flint's public water from the Detroit system to the Flint River caused corrosion in the aging pipes and exposed thousands of residents to dangerous levels of lead. This week, a congressional panel began looking into who's responsible for the failure in Flint, from the local government to the EPA and even Governor Rick Snyder. I got a chance to speak with Kurt Guyette in Pittsburgh when he was in town for a panel discussion about lead and water at Point Park University. When you look at the field of environmental journalism and health, it's sometimes difficult to point to health impacts like those that people have experienced in Flint, like losing their hair and elevated levels of lead in children's blood, and connect that to a specific pollution point or events. But that's exactly what's happened in Flint. And so I'm just wondering how you investigate that chain of causation.
Well, actually, the key factor in Flint didn't have anything to do with me directly. It had to do with a doctor at Hurley Medical Center who, after we were involved in doing the independent study of lead in Flint's water, took it upon herself to look at lead blood levels in children under 5 and compared them to a 9-month period before the switch to the Flint River to a 9-month period after the Flint River, and was able to show that after the switch to the river, the percentage of kids with elevated levels of lead in their blood doubled. And it only happened in Flint. The rest of the county that Flint is located in, Genesee County, remained on the Detroit system for water. And so they were able to show, you know, direct correlation between the switch to the river and elevated levels of lead in the blood of kids. And so, you know, that was not my reporting, but it was crucial information to bring out because it did show causation. But it was also our previous work to investigate to find out what the lead levels in the water were that caused that doctor to do that. So there's a little bit of a chain reaction.
This story has a lot of components of race and class, which are also traditionally in environmental reporting, very difficult to report on. So can you talk a little bit about the role that those play in this reporting the story?
One thing for certain is that the school districts and cities in Michigan that have been taken over by emergency managers taken over by the state are majority African American with high poverty rates. Flint's probably about 56-57% African American with a poverty rate of 40%. Detroit, which was taken over by emergency managers, 85% black with poverty rate, I think, around 40% as well. So these are African-American cities and school districts and poor cities that are being taken over like this and having democracy taken away from them as a result of this emergency manager law. Yeah, and the other thing that's going on is it's not just only poor African-American cities that are having this infrastructure crisis that is part of this. The federal government has cut back tremendously on the amount of funding it gives for water and sewer infrastructure, and as a result, the costs are being placed increasingly on the backs of ratepayers, and poor people are being, water is being put out of their price range. We saw it in Detroit. Tens of thousands of people the past couple years have gotten their water cut off because people just simply cannot afford the bills. And Flint, they were paying $150 a month for their water. You know, the highest rates in the country for water that they couldn't drink.
It's a different kind of water war. We're hearing a lot about the water wars in California. It's a different kind of thing in this water-rich region that we have.
Absolutely. You know, Flint's right in the heart of the Great Lakes system, which has 20% of the world's fresh surface water. You would think that no place would water be cheaper or cleaner. But because of the costs and the costs associated with the aging infrastructure, these people were poisoned because the state was trying to save some money.
Why did it take so long for other media to pick up on this story and respond to the public outcry about the water problems that people in Flint were experiencing?
I think there's a number of factors involved there. One is that the government continued to maintain that the water was safe. And, you know, people, even reporters, tend to believe the government is going to tell them the truth when asked a question. So that's part of it. I think there also might be a little reluctance or hesitation, trepidation, something this big. I'm not even sure the right word, but when you're saying, geez, a whole town of 100,000 people is getting lead poisoned because their water is not being treated properly, that is a pretty huge claim to be making. And, you know, people are reluctant to go too far out on a limb with something that huge.
You're here in Pittsburgh to talk about your reporting in Flint, which is a very specific situation with an emergency manager and decisions to save money by switching the city's water source, and that caused the lead contamination. But what can other cities, especially here in the Rust Belt, learn from what happened in Flint?
You know, it's hard to say, talk about good things coming out of Flint because of the tragedy is so severe and heartbreaking. But definitely one thing that is happening is a heightened awareness about the potential for lead in people's water. Michigan is not the only state where the Department of Environmental Quality conducts its water sampling in a way that causes the results to skew low. Somebody just told me today that there's been a significant increase in the number of people asking for the water to be tested for lead here in Pittsburgh. And I said, well, you know what? It's not enough to just have their water tested. They need to find out what the protocols are for conducting those tests. Because if they're doing certain things that a number of states are doing where loopholes in the law are being exploited, they need to know that because they're not really getting accurate results if that's going on. Even the size of the bottles that they use. The rule is that you're supposed to put your bottle under the tap and turn the tap on full speed, because the faster the water is moving, the more likely it is to dislodge lead particles. In Michigan, they were using bottles that were like pop bottles with a small opening, which would kind of be a natural deterrent to people turning the water on full speed. You're going to run it slow. Whereas Virginia Tech, which we worked with to conduct independent tests, they had bottles that, like mayonnaise jars, big, wide, open mouths, so you could do just that. So there's a lot of sneaky tactics used by different states in order to minimize the amount of lead they are finding, because if they end up over the federal action level, then there's a likelihood they're going to have to start replacing these lead service lines, which is a big cost. And so there is a financial incentive to not find lead.
The Allegheny Front is a nonprofit environmental news program, and I think sometimes that makes people think we're environmentalists mm-hmm. and biased, which is not how we are approaching environmental news. And you're a reporter for the ACLU, which is a human rights organization. And I'm wondering how you manage that relationship as a journalist and the expectations that people have of reporters.
I've been a reporter for more than 30 years, and the mindset that I've always had is the one that I bring to this job, and that the bottom line is whatever people want to call you is the work, and is the work that you're producing accurate, fair, credible. As long as those criteria are being met, and you build the reputation of producing that kind of work, you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine.
How has reporting this story in Flint changed you as a journalist, or what are you taking away from it?
It's had a profound effect on me, just in terms of how I feel about the people of Flint. I don't live in Flint. I live in the Detroit area. Flint's about 70 miles away. I'm not even sure I was ever in Flint before I started reporting this story. But my feelings for the people of Flint run very deeply. I really love it and feel connected to it. That's probably the biggest personal effect on me. But it certainly has made me very proud of the ACLU of Michigan, that they had enough foresight to try something new, to give me the opportunity. I tell people that I can't even call this my dream job, because I didn't ever envision being in a situation like this before.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Kurt Guyette is an investigative reporter with the ACLU of Michigan. He broke the story about the lead water crisis in Flint, Michigan. There's more about his work and related stories on lead and water at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Would you pay more when you flipped on the light switch at dusk if you knew you'd be billed less later when fewer people were using that electricity? Some customers are finding this arrangement makes sense for their budgets.
The average savings has kind of hovered between $100 and $200 for kind of the four-month period we offer it.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, electricity providers think time-of-use pricing is a bright idea for our energy future. Stay tuned. And now we're going to play a round of the game we're calling, How Much Do You Know About GMOs? Genetically modified organisms are, of course, plants or animals that have been altered down to the level of their DNA. That's a change that's made in the lab. It's been used to create crops that are more resistant to pests and to make an animal, like a GMO salmon, grow faster. One thing we know for sure about GMOs is that they've been very controversial. Some food advocates are concerned about the safety of genetically modified foods and their impact on the environment. Others say there's no science that proves there's anything to worry about. And lots of consumers are left in the middle with questions and confusion. So we're playing this little game to see how much we know about some of these issues. Our contestants today are the Allegheny Front's reporters, Reed Frazier and Julie Grant. Welcome, you two.
Hey, Kara.
Hi, Kara.
Hi, guys. We'll play this quiz Jeopardy style. So I'll give you a fact or a statement about GMOs, and you'll buzz in and answer with a question. Ready?
Okay.
Yep.
Here we go. So our categories are Monsanto, fruits and veggies, fast food, and labeling. Okay, Reed, you start.
I'll take Monsanto for 200, Kara.
In 1996, Monsanto introduced genetically modified corn and soybeans that can withstand this popular herbicide.
What is oregano? Oregano is a herbicide, right?
That is an herb that you use to cook, but that's not exactly what we're talking about. Sorry.
What is Roundup?
That's right. Roundup Ready seeds account for 90% of all corn and soybeans grown in the U.S. But as we've reported, Roundup kills milkweed plants, and less milkweed means fewer monarch butterflies. Okay, Julie, your turn.
All right, I'll take fruits and vegetables for 500.
This was the first GMO food to hit the market. Its genetic modification allowed this salad staple to stay fresh longer. Yes, Reed.
What is the flavor-saver tomato?
Yes, that's correct. But no matter how you slice it, consumers didn't go for it, and you won't find it in your grocery store. All right, Reed, your turn again.
Okay, I'll take fast food for 300.
This chain came up with the marketing campaign called GMO Over It. Reed?
What is Whole Foods?
I'm sorry, that is not correct. Julie, what's your answer?
What is Chipotle?
Yes, Chipotle. But as we'll find out in a bit, Chipotle is being called out for not exactly going GMO-free. Julie, with two correct answers, you're the winner of today's quiz.
All right.
And you get to move on to the next round, GMO labeling. And I just want to say thank you and farewell to our, I don't want to say losing contestant, but to our energy reporter, Reed Frazier. Thanks so much, Reed.
First runner-up at the Allegheny Front GMO Jeopardy. So 2016. What?
Thanks, Reed.
Thank you.
Okay, Julie, you take this quiz to the next round. This bill would have banned states from requiring GMO labels on foods, and it failed in the Senate this week.
Well, I know this one from my reporting this week. What is the SAFE Act?
That's right. Officially, the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act by proponents. And opponents call it by a different name, the DARK Act, Denying Americans the Right to Know Act. And Julie, you know more about this bill than I do, so tell me more about it.
One of the questions I've been reporting on is about milk, specifically milk from cows that have been fed genetically modified food. And the question is, should that be labeled as GMO? I visited with one farmer who's taken his argument to Congress. Warren Taylor grew up taste testing milk. His father's job was to judge milk, and he brought it home to the kitchen table.
I grew up not being able to just enjoy my dairy products. I had to judge them from the time I was old enough to know the difference.
Both Taylor and his brother had careers in the dairy industry, working for bigger companies. Taylor could have retired. Instead, he and his wife invested $2 million in Snowville Creamery, a small dairy processor in rural southern Ohio. He sells milk and yogurt to Whole Foods and other stores, and he has some interesting flavors.
My wife, Victoria, cooked up all these flavors in our kitchen, and she calls this tiramisu. Can I try that?
That is so good. Taylor's almost giddy as he opens the door to show off the creamery's fully stainless steel processing room.
This is where we do the magic. This is where the alchemy happens, where the milk is separated, pasteurized, cultured, packaged.
Cows on most U.S. farms eat feed from genetically engineered crops like Roundup Ready corn. Taylor gets his milk from nearby dairy farms, and he's very careful about what they eat.
Our cows are all fed only non-GMO feed. All the feed that they eat, every load has been tested with very sophisticated equipment to confirm it's non-GMO.
Taylor's worried he's going to lose the niche he's created, selling regional, GMO-free milk products. He says some big dairies are labeling their products as non-GMO, even though their milk comes from cows that eat genetically modified food. In fact, a woman in California is suing Chipotle over its claims to have a GMO-free menu. The lawsuit alleges Chipotle serves meat, cheese, and sour cream from animals that eat GMOs, like corn and soy. What Taylor wants is
that we have a federal law that's clear and honest and not meant to prejudice in favor of genetic engineering.
Taylor's been spending a lot of time in Washington to lobby for GMO labeling. He fought against the Senate bill because it didn't mandate labeling.
You know, I think voluntary labeling is it's a dodge. It's dishonest. It means no labeling at all.
The Senate just voted down that bill, which some consumer advocates call a win. But for Taylor's business, the heart of this debate still comes back to whether milk from cows that eat genetically modified feed should be considered genetically modified itself. Dave Carlin, a vice president at the International Dairy Foods Association, says,
just because you feed a cow GM feed does not make the milk that comes from that cow GM.
His group represents big milk, yogurt, and cheesemakers like Borden and Dannon.
Just as if we would fed a cow chocolate, doesn't make the milk that comes out of that cow chocolate milk. It just doesn't work that way.
The Food and Drug Administration agrees. In an email, the FDA says when cows eat GMO feed, it doesn't make their milk GMO. The milk itself is not genetically engineered. So the issue comes down to informing consumers. The big dairy industry group supported the Senate bill, the one that would have kept all GMO labeling voluntary and prevented states from creating tougher requirements. Some companies like Campbell Soup have already started identifying genetically engineered ingredients on their labels. Carlin says that's fine if they want to, but it shouldn't be required.
Because there is no health or safety reason why GMO labeling should be required, there's not a good argument for why we should mandate companies to disclose that information.
But the disclosure of artificial colors, artificial sweeteners, farm-raised salmon, concentrated orange juice, all of these things are not a safety issue.
Chris Miller is the social activism manager with Ben & Jerry's, the ice cream maker that was purchased by food giant Unilever.
We don't allow food companies to sell something that's unsafe by putting a label on it. This is not a warning label. This is not about safety. This is about transparency and consumers understanding what it is they buy. It's that simple.
Miller says GMO seeds are patented, so they're inherently different. And surveys show a majority of Americans support GMO labeling. But the food industry says mandating labels would be like a scarlet letter, an unnecessary warning to consumers. So where does this debate leave Ohio dairy evangelist Warren Taylor? Even Ben & Jerry's uses milk from cows that eat GMO feed without labeling it as such.
We have a right to know the process. We have a right to support the processes by which our food is produced, grown, and make our own judgment, thank you, about whether or not we support those processes or not.
Now that the Senate has killed the voluntary labeling bill, Democrats are proposing other bills and say they've been trying to negotiate a bipartisan solution. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
This is Reed Frazier, reporter for the Allegheny Front, and I have an important announcement to make. Over the last few weeks, you might have noticed something different about us. No, we haven't been working out. And no, this tattoo, we got that years ago. We have a new website. Same address, AlleghenyFront.org, but it looks a lot different. It's got lots of photos, videos, and special sections. Of course, it is a work in progress, and we'd love your feedback. You can find us in all the usual places, on Facebook, on Twitter, at Allegheny Front, or good old-fashioned email, info@AlleghenyFront.org. Hope to see you online.
Knowing what's in the products you buy at the grocery store is one consumer issue. Knowing how much you're charged for a service is another. Historically, electricity pricing has been relatively straightforward. The more you use, the more you pay. But today, that simple equation is not so simple. Increasingly, the time of day when you use electricity factors into that cost as well. As Inside Energy's Stephanie Joyce reports, so-called time-of-use pricing saves money and energy. But it's not always popular.
You're probably already familiar with the concept of time-of-use pricing, just maybe not for electricity. Let's talk about parking for a second. If you pull into a parking garage in downtown Denver on a Tuesday morning at 8 a.m. and want to park there all day, you're going to fork over some serious cash.
It is $17 a day to park.
Pull into that same parking garage on a Saturday at 8 a.m.
$5.
Brandy Gall, the Denver office manager for Douglas Parking, says the price varies so much for a very simple reason.
Supply and demand.
On weekdays, a lot of people want to park downtown. On weekends, not so much. Electricity demand fluctuates too. For example,
4 o'clock on a hot summer afternoon, everyone's starting to get home from work. They're plugging in and turning on their air conditioners. They're turning on their TV and lights. And all of a sudden, power demand is just rising and rising.
That's Mark Dyson, a power expert at the Rocky Mountain Institute, a think tank. He says right now, most utilities deal with those spikes in demand by turning on natural gas power plants built specifically for that situation.
Those power plants are just sitting around waiting to be used on hot summer afternoons.
He's not exaggerating. A lot of those natural gas peaker plants only run a few days a year. But there's another way to do things, one that doesn't involve building huge, expensive power plants. What if we just avoided turning on our air conditioners all at once?
Summer. Energy costs more during peak hours from 2 to 7 p.m. weekdays when demand is highest. But shift some of your use to the other 19 weekday hours or all weekend and you can save risk-free.
That's an advertisement from Oklahoma Gas and Electric, one of the early adopters of time-of-use pricing. For the last few years, the company has had a program called Smart Hours. Customers who sign up for it pay more between 2 and 7 p.m. in the summer, when it costs the utility more to make electricity, and less the rest of the time, when it costs less. Kathleen O'Shea is a spokeswoman for OG&E.
The price can range anywhere from half price, which is about 5 cents, up to 43. 43 cents a kilowatt obviously is intended to motivate them to not use as much. But, hey, that's their choice.
Most people choose to cut back on their use when the price is highest, usually by cooling their homes in the morning and then turning off their air conditioners when prices rise in the afternoon. O'Shea says people sign on because it saves them money.
You know, the average savings has kind of hovered between $100 and $200 for kind of the four-month period we offer it. But that's an average.
And then there are the super savers.
You'll have people who are saving $500, $600. Because it, you know, some people just really get into this kind of stuff.
OG&E is also saving a lot of money by not having to build more power plants.
I don't think any utility really wants to go out and build a new power plant.
Which is one reason utilities from Oregon to Colorado to Texas are starting to offer time-of-use pricing for residential customers. In California, they're taking it one step further. In 2019, time-of-use pricing will become the default for the state's three largest utilities. Mark Dyson, the power expert with the Rocky Mountain Institute, says he anticipates some pushback. After all, in the past, we never had to think about when we used electricity. But he says in the future, technology will make it so we don't have to again, and that ultimately, time-of-use pricing will be good for everyone.
It saves money for the folks that are able to reduce their consumption during peak hours, and it also saves money for the rest of the customers in the utility service territory who don't have to finance the construction of a new power plant just to meet peak demand.
And maybe someday it will seem just as natural as paying different prices for parking on weekdays and weekends. For Inside Energy, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. Thanks for listening to The Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Carol Holsapple. Join us again here next time, or find us online on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front.
Support for The Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.